Okay, this is Shelley Droman, and it is July 8th, 1999, and I am with Sir John Krakalovich. Is that right? Say your name right.
More or less. It's Sir John Krakalovich.
Okay, and you're from Slavonski Brod?
Yeah.
Croatia.
That's right. That's where I was born.
Okay. Tell me a little bit about your hometown. What's
it like? Well, it's about... its population is about 70,000, 80,000. Mm-hmm. It's sort of hard to get a picture of it on the basis of that figure. I mean, Bowling Green is what, 50,000 maybe? And in my opinion, there's nothing in it. The amount of people that live here, the structure and the way cities develop is sort of different over there. Because obviously places are older because Europe has been populated for a longer period of time. It's a fairly flat city. It's on the banks of a river,
mm-hmm.
Sava, flows into Danube in Belgrade. So I don't really know what to say about it. It's been probably about 6 years since I properly thought about it. I pretty much took it as granted that I'm never going to return. So it hasn't been a major factor in my thoughts, but what's it like? Slightly Victorian, classic, quite European. The usual picture that you would meet in a old Austrian city or town. A very big square. It's accustomed to just have walks across the square, almost flat, almost nothing on it, except not a bench and a nice light. People selling ice cream, feeding pigeons, and walking along the bank of the river. I don't know why, it was completely brown, industrialized, etc. I loved it because I was born there, and all of my family roots were sort of in the area. That part of Croatia where I was born, where my mother's family is from, where my grandmother lived, it's like very green. It's considered to be the pantry of Croatia, almost, if you wish. So, the people are sometimes very simple, but always very good, very hospitable. But then again, I wouldn't want to say anything else about the place that I'm from. Actually, I don't know. I don't know what to say. I just like it. I tend not to describe things too much. I don't like labels. I would like to convey the feeling, but that's quite hard.
How about your living in an apartment?
Initially, it was a house. Actually, what happened was my mom had sort of a teacher's degree from a university, I think, in Slavonski Brod. What happened was she got a job across the river. Now, bear in mind that this was during Yugoslavia. There was no distinction between Bosnia and Croatia. So, and as Slavonski Brod was on the very border, which was the river Sava, it was pretty much irrelevant where you were. You were a citizen of Yugoslavia and you simply wouldn't care. She got a job across the river, so to speak, and met my dad, and basically got employed at a local school in a small village of maybe, 1,000, 2,000 people, called Vinska. And I think for the first few years of my life, we lived there with my dad's parents, and it was a very nice little farm with, I mean, my grandfather was just a completely rural person. He grew corn and wheat, and he had vineyards and vineyards, actually. I don't say that word that much. I should, it's very nice. Fruits, plums, everything you can imagine. And then we moved sort of down the road a little bit to a school, actually. I lived in a school, in an actual school, for about, 8 years of my life, 7 years of my life, something like that. What it was a school where my mom and dad were teaching. they were both teaching math. My dad also taught physics. And it had two apartments for school teachers. And that's where we lived. And that was funny. Very innocent. When I moved to the city at the age of 10, I mean, in American terms, it's not a city, but industrially it was strong. It had a refinery of oil, so much richer than the countryside. And the cultural distinction was the prevailing factor that was to determine my assimilation to the city culture, if you wish, because villagers, I don't know how else to translate the word, people that people from the country are called in our country are considered to be very simple and often stupid and are ridiculed, especially if you're a kid. It's a bad thing to be from there. Now, something that's not typical for a typical country kid, I didn't really have that much of a country accent, and people usually do. But there were a few things that, since my parents were teachers, right, I guess it was natural, not that I really cared, but there were a few words that were quite typical for the area where I was coming from at that time. So my initial impression of Bosanski Brod, which is where I lived up until the war, was I was alienated, I think, for a while as a kid. Had problems just because I came from somewhere else. So at a very young age, I started feeling as an alien, as a stranger, if you wish, which later on I think helped me love people unconditionally, in a strange kind of way. You run from one extreme and hug the other one, sort of thing.
How about brothers and sisters? Do you have one sister?
Well, my mother was married twice. Her first husband died, and then she remarried with my dad. And from her first marriage, she has the other child, and she only has two, my half-sister and me. I call her my sister, and she's my sister. She's 6 years older than me. She was born in 1970. And she, well, I haven't seen her for 7 years now.
So she didn't come with you volunteering?
No. She had, a different life.
Where does she live now?
She's in Sweden.
In Sweden.
She finished high school, obviously much earlier than I have, and went to the University of Zagreb to study physics. She was intending to specialize in nuclear physics, a very excellent student, everything. And somewhere along the way, she decided to ditch all that. I think it was halfway through her third year at university that she became enthralled with the idea of the whole Hare Krishna respect and religion thing. It seems to fulfill her entirely, and ever since, I think, 1990 is a fairly reasonable estimate, she stuck to it, devoted 100% of herself to it, as she usually does with everything else. And right now she's in Sweden, married, happily, I hope. Actually, she might be coming this fall, which will be weird, to say the least. Seeing her, having changed her ideology so much since the last time I experienced her presence, and I've changed so much. Last time I was around, she was bossing me around like a little kid, which is what I was.
take out the trash, you know, I'm your big sister, listen to me, you know, or I'm gonna smack ya. So right now we're sort of on equal footing, and my priorities have changed, and I've been to a lot of places, and she's been to a lot of places, and we've all been to a lot of places, and it's fun.
Tell me about how you made the decision to leave Croatia.
Well, it was all a mess. My first feeling, and I guess the primary reason for leaving, was extreme discomfort and utter lack of safety and trust in people whom I've lived with for years and years, and whose priority all of a sudden became my ethnic background, my genes, which I was completely unaware of. Anyway, and which, in my opinion, don't construe any part of my personality.
What
like,
ethnic background are you?
Well, my father is ethnically a Serb, mm-hmm. and my mother is ethnically a Croat. So, it was a weird situation. I was completely for the idea of Yugoslavia. At the time, it sounded absolutely great. I felt like a Yugoslav. Didn't have anything against anyone. I still don't. Probably never will. So when more or less all people around you come up to you and tell you, "We'll can't do this, can't do that, or we'll kill you if you do that," which they did, my peers, you sort of start feeling, well, a bit insecure. So at the time, I actually found myself in the middle of, I don't know how to describe it, confusion. The idea of your country suddenly disappearing and all of these countries creating themselves out of nowhere with artificial borders, it seemed at the time, was just breathtaking. And I left it all to my parents, of course. Didn't want to deal with it, couldn't deal with it. I was 15 years of age at the time. So at first I stayed in Bosnia as soon as I could, and then I left to Croatia to split, to live with my uncle for a while until like everything sorted out, but it didn't, of course. And in October 92, my town fell to the Serb forces. And we ended up going to Poland, still as refugees from Bosanski Brod, on a program that was sort of a collaboration between Polish and Bosnian governments to relocate the schools until everything sorts out. It was a makeshift refugee program. Oh, all of a sudden you can't really go back. It's occupied. Okay, so that kind of thing. I actually had trouble. That was a sort of a humanitarian effort on the part of the Polish government. Okay. Nobody really thought that Bosanski Brod, the town in Bosnia, where my mom and dad worked and where we lived, was going to fall. Stories are, and I am convinced, and everybody is who really was there and knows the course of things, the course that things took, that it was exchanged for another town in eastern Bosnia that was held by the Serbs. It was sort of like, oh, give us that and we'll give you this. There was a little bit of illegal action taking place at the time, because although it was Bosnian territory, Croatian army was commanding the whole operation of the defense of the city, and it ordered the local army to suddenly, in the middle of war, take 2 weeks leave. And they walked in, and something like a day or two later, they just withdrew. They just left. They said the town is getting occupied, everybody get out. So that's how it fell, quote unquote. And that was it. That was it. I had to go somewhere else. I knew I couldn't stay in Bosnia because I was of mixed origin. The atmosphere in Croatia was very aggressive towards anybody who had anything to do with the Serbs. My father was a Serb, so I didn't feel safe there. I spent about 5 months in Split, and it was very tense. Living with my uncle, even they had something to do against it. They were wondering whether to trust my dad or not, although my mom was still with him. Guests would come by, realize that I had a Serb father, and I would overhear them saying that, you know, if you want this guy to stay alive, you will have to do something with him. I lived close to the beach. I spent a lot of time at the beach in Split, and on the way to the beach, I would see the graffitis on the wall, which would just keep on reappearing every day. New ones, kill the Serbs, Serbs keep out, very extremist right-wing attitudes were popular. That was the in thing at the time. So I just kept low and hoped to get out of the whole Balkan area as soon as possible. And of course, when we went to Poland, that came true.
Would you have felt comfortable in Yugoslavia?
Oh, no.
No.
What's Yugoslavia right now? Serbia? Montenegro? Mm-hmm. I've only been there like once. I don't really know the place. The family that I do have in Belgrade, I'm fairly distant towards. I mean, you know, it's like having a phone number from a girl you know won't go out with you and calling her anyway. It was something that had nothing for me there. And I saw, and everybody who had anything happen to them in the war saw, that it was slowly moving from Slovenia to Croatia through Bosnia, and Serbia was going to get it next. Mm-hmm. So there was no safety there, and it was just like, get out of the whole place. So definitely no.
So how did you get out?
Well, spending time in Poland was interesting and a complete waste of space, time, and money, because we were just sitting there without permissions to work, without adequate financial or any other assistance. We were just being kept alive. We were given enough food and a symbolic amount of money, thinly veiled as, you know, pocket change. I think it was southwestern Poland, the area that belonged to Germany before World War II. High up in the mountains, near a ski resort called Zakopane, which is actually quite popular right now. Because Poland is part of the European Union now, and tourism there is just cheap because they want to sell it. And it's good. It's very comfortable there. Clean air, etc. And everybody left us alone.
Well, how did you get, if you were living with your uncle, how did you get back together with your family before you left Poland?
Well, my family wasn't allowed to leave the city of Bosanski Brod because my father was a Serb. My mom had to stay there to protect his life, which several times was in danger. She had to intervene with the army commander for the town. I mean, people were simply coming to the door saying, we'll kill him. And if it weren't for the neighbors who knew us, appreciated us, respected us, my dad would probably be dead right now, and my mom probably with him. So that was the reason they stuck together. My dad couldn't leave, my mom was with him. And when the town fell, they obviously phoned my uncle in Split and said, come up to Osijek, which is another town in Croatia, actually a city, a bigger one, where we were to prepare to leave for Poland. And what we did there, we spent about a week and did a lot of red tape. What Polish officials did was to drag over a train from Poland and treat it as Polish territory in Osijek. They set up a makeshift embassy, I guess you could call it, where they just issued us alien travel documents, which would enable us to get through Hungary and what have you to get to Poland. That's how we got together. That's how we ended up in Poland.
What did they carry with them from your home, and what did you carry with you?
Practically nothing. Yes, practically nothing. Nothing really. Just the clothes that I had on me, plus whatever I could fit in my bag, all our belongings, the car, everything. It was all left behind. The jewelry, money. We didn't really have money. We use our money. We don't accumulate it. So it wasn't like a life savings to be left behind. So, no, really nothing. Empty pockets.
Photos?
Well, some, yeah. Like, maybe 100 photos all in all were saved. But there was so much that was lost. That meant a lot. Emotionally, and it was just trauma for my parents more than me. Because I didn't like the place anyway. But I was 15 years old. What did I know? You know, I'm only starting to respect adequately what being human is. And my mom and my dad, they were people in their 40s at the time. The loss of whatever they had meant so much more for them because they worked their whole lives to get it. And all of a sudden it's like, boom, you're not going to be there anymore. We're going to take that away. If you kill those relatives, you know, and burn their house down and burn your house down, and we're going to kill you, blah, 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 blah. So, you know, they're the ones who suffered from neurosis. I was the one who was composed because of ignorance, really. I made myself stay out of it. Very quiet, very withdrawn as a personality. Mm-hmm. Didn't really change until I left Poland, actually, in that respect. Because there was no other choice. I didn't want to affiliate myself with either the Serb camp or the Croat camp or the Muslim camp. There was no camps in between. And, you know, I was the quiet guy in the middle reading a book and keeping himself to himself. So.
What about your first day in Poland? Do you remember?
That was funny. They provided accommodation for us. I don't know how to call the accommodation. The Bosnian language, Croatian language, Serbian language expression for it is mountain house, where skiers and hikers go and stay during their five-day holiday, perhaps in the mountains. And the government hired those little houses. They were wonderful, surrounded by pine forests and, oh, just breathtaking scenery. And put refugees in there. So we were basically in hotels. And the hotel that I was designated to was at the very top of the area. The day was stormy as hell. Rain wasn't falling, it was flying horizontally. The wind was amazing. And there was no transport to take us to the top. So on my first day in Poland, I walked about 2 miles uphill, very steep uphill, with an umbrella like horizontally in front of me. And that was my first day in Poland. Very brown, very bleak, very miserable. Depression redefined. Yeah.
Did you know the other people?
I knew a lot of them. They were all from Bosanski Brod. But it was a fairly big place, so I didn't know all of them. But yes, I did know a lot. And some of them weren't very delighted to see me. I met up with this girl whom I knew from before, and she was a Croat, a clear Croat ethnically. And we started dating, we just fell for each other. And a bunch of guys came up to us and said, separately, obviously, that, well, they're gonna kill me if I don't quit dating her. So we just drew apart. And that was like the line that was drawn between us and them, if you wish. Only it wasn't us and them, but them and me. And so I was one of maybe 5-10 kids who were ethnically mixed. Everybody else was either this or that. No Serbs, obviously, in that camp. It was purely Croat. Apart from my dad.
So did he have friends that he talked to or not? He just kept to himself?
Well, if you can imagine living with someone, knowing that they're talking about you behind your back, that if they could, they would harm you, but because of the situation, they can't. And as a consequence, they're pretending to be polite. That was the summary of the existence. Hi, hello, how are you? Have you had a nice day? Yes, let's sit down and talk about blah, 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 blah. But in reality, it wasn't comfortable. Felt like an outsider, for my dad especially. And he did lose an eye during fighting. He was, even in his young age, he was, okay, everybody in ex-Yugoslavia did national service for the army. He was told not to because he had a back problem. There was something wrong with his spine. So he was designated to do civil service, which is nothing close to the army and the training that you have to go through. So in the event of war, he would not bear arms. He's not trained to use them. Maybe like, you know, if you really have to. But he wasn't like a commando or anything close to that. And when it came to the confrontation between the Croat / Muslim authority in the wartime Bosanski Brod, the time where my mother had to protect him, when they saw it would be quite hard to get rid of this guy, my dad, because he did have quite a lot of support from his from Croat and Muslim friends who knew him well and respected him, they simply forcefully mobilized him and sent him to the front line, where he spent I don't know how long he spent there, but sooner or later anyway, a grenade exploded fairly near to him and one shrapnel went through his head, knocking out his left eye. So he's an invalid of war. And that coupled with everything else was just, I just brought him down. He's changed, he's not my dad anymore. He's a closed personality, he keeps himself very much to himself. It's impossible to access his emotions. Absolutely impossible. I mean, my mom and I try all the time to bring him out, because here in America, he doesn't really have to fear all the other stuff that he had on his neck back home. And but it's hard. He's really it really made him hide. So I don't know. I'm smiling, but only because it turned out well in the end. At least for me and for all of us. Hell, we're alive. I'm not going to complain.
How did you get to the United States?
Ooh, okay. I don't know. I have no idea how I ended up in the United States. It was never my intention. Never wanted to live in the United States. Never had anything that vaguely attracted me to the United States. Wanted to, say, visit. For the sake of places like Vegas, Niagara Falls, D.C.,
did you say
Seattle.
Vegas?
Yeah.
Okay.
Just the attractions, Grand Canyon, Veni Vidi Vici, that kind of stuff. I didn't really want to call it my home. But after Poland, the events that followed Poland and just everything that happened with my parents and me just left only one door open for a possibility of a peaceful life, and that was America, because we had the opportunity to go back to Croatia. Bosnia, we could go back to Bosnia, but if we did, it would not be good for my mom and dad. Bosnia right now is, I don't want to think about it. You know, people are divided. Bosnia was not divided before the war. It was like a very good chili. Everything was well mixed up. Right now, everything is being plucked out, and Serbs are on one side, and Croats on the other side and Muslims on the other side, and everybody hates everybody else. Croatia is more westernized right now. It's getting close to the European Union. It's neighbors with Slovenia. Slovenia is a member of the EC, so it has a pressure on it to accept the value of human rights, basically. And it's getting better. But they have fairly extreme laws as a young country. For example, although my dad is married to my mom, and my mom would have no problem becoming a citizen of Croatia because she's born there, and so am I. It was actually harder for me to get Bosnian documents than Croatian documents. I sent them over to the Bosnian embassy, and I got a letter saying, according to what we see, you are a citizen of Croatia. Tell us something that, and I wanted Bosnian documents because obviously then I would be a refugee and I could go back, because that's what I needed to do then. I couldn't do anything for myself. I needed the help of others. It's very bad to be dependent. It really makes you fine and your self-esteem. But he would have to wait 5 years in event of going back to Croatia before he would get citizenship and have a right to work. Economically, Croatia wasn't at that point in time, still isn't now, really that well off for my mom to support all of us. And it was just a no-no. Plus, I would have to do national service in Croatia, and I did not want to do anything with the army. So America, yeah, okay, let's give it a shot. And it worked. It worked, and it worked. And we didn't come over here as a lot of people did for financial reasons. A lot of people were refugees in Germany for a number of years. And she said, oh, America, America, bit će nam bolje tamo, tamo će biti super, imat ćemo toliko para. I mean, just like, we'll have more money there. They expected social security, something, I don't know what else. Germany is a very social state. You get a lot of it for free. And, you know, look at what my people did to my country. They're very greedy, and they can be very selfish, given the opportunity. And I feel like a lot of people who are here have come for superficial reasons. And I'm glad that I didn't. I came here because I needed it. This was it. I couldn't be free over there, or over there, or over there. And over here, it's like, okay, fair enough. We're not going to like support you or anything, but we're giving you a chance to work. We're giving you a chance to study. You know, go ahead. Here, prove yourself. That's all I wanted. And nobody, the whole thing about being a refugee was that nobody would give you a chance to do anything for yourself. Couldn't do anything for yourself. The only way to live was to ask from others. I don't want to do that.
How did you get located in Kentucky?
Pure chance. I came over here before my parents, and it's like, if you can imagine a map of the United States, refugee centers here and there, towns everywhere, somebody flipping a coin, or, you know, just like spinning the arrow, and oh, it's Bowling Green, Kentucky. Okay, that was it.
What did you think it would be like?
I didn't. I made myself have no expectations. I spent 4 years in England, met a lot of Americans in the process, spoke and was close to a lot of people who went to America. So from the people whom I trusted, I got a fairly good impression of what Americans' attitudes, cultural values, or lack thereof, as undoubtedly you know, is the usual European stance on the issue. I was fairly well prepared, so I was like, well, I'm not going to expect anything. I'm just going to go there, see what I find, and go from there. And I didn't. And I must say, after almost a year and a half being here, I don't feel a tinge of nostalgia for anything. There's so many people running around with big old Bosnian flags sprawled across their cars, and just, oh, we want to go back, we want to go back, we want to go back. You're not there, you're here, and I'm just making the best of it, having a good time doing it.
How about your first day here?
Space. Yeah. Space was what got me. In a crowded city of New York, there was so much space. And, I mean, I lived in Europe for 20, 1 year of my life, and I've never seen trucks that big. I mean, why? You know, it's like, why are cars this big? Why are streets this wide? You don't need it. You know, it was a thing of comfort. The whole thing, everything that I saw, the airport, the streets, the city, the building spoke, we have space, we're going to use it. You know, it's like, I'm right. Big cars, somebody's idea of a car is like, it's the drag strip mentality, I guess you could describe it as. You know, Mustangs, Camaros, big old tanks. Okay? Those are considered sexy cars here. My idea of a sexy car, the sexiest car, is something small, powerful, agile, something that's tiny but has power. And ability, concentrated force, quality. You know, take only as much space as you need to do something. You know, it's like I'm gonna feel comfortable in what's this? Maybe spreading my feet across 4 feet of space. What's that? A meter and 50 centimeters. You know, in America, well, I can have 2.5. That's what, you know, it's like, I don't want that. I utilize my space, I utilize my time, I've been taught to, I recognize the quality of doing that, of managing your resources the best way you possibly can, and the first impression I got here was basically such an enormous waste of energy and space and words and everything. It was a cultural shock, really. Which is what I expected, but I just soaked it in. It was nice. I had a grin on my face. Dealing with this will be fun, kind of thing. So.
Right now, it'd probably be good. Let's just take a little break. Okay, so I'll pause. Do you want to take a little break?
You have my permission.
Okay, so I'll pause the tape. All right, we're back from our break. Oh, you were talking about space and using it. Do you think a lot of people have adjusted to that kind of space? I mean, I see some people driving Cadillacs. And
oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think, it's hard not to diss those people right now. Because, say, in a typical primary school in Bosnia, you will have a certain amount of people who will think they are harder than everybody else. And in terms of, I'm stronger than you, I can beat you up, who are you to say anything? Jerks. And a jerk will drive a Cadillac. If a jerk can drive a Cadillac, the jerk will. So that's what they do. And again, not all Cadillac drivers are jerks, but, you know, a lot of them do that. They buy cars and get apartments and just buy things with the money they don't have. The things that they buy, they don't like, and they're buying it for people who don't like them, just so that those people can say, oh, he's got a very big car, I better get a bigger one. It's that's materialism. It's showing off. It's, I don't know. That's what I think it is. Selfishness.
I'm intrigued by the, for so long, Yugoslavia was a communist country.
Socialist.
And people were really happy with that. They liked it at that time. I hear a lot of good things about Yugoslavia at that time. What do you think would be the big, the biggest adjustment? I mean, we're talking about space and the use of, you know, in purchasing things as status symbols. How would you relate that to the way you grew up?
The way I grew up.
Or in how people, even the older people that grew up and spent many, many more years than you did under a socialist system, to then come and start doing a lot of purchasing big American cars. And
well, the only thing that I have to speak from in those terms is my own meandering experience. My mom is the head of our household. Her idea of money is energy. Get it, use it well. Make sure you don't dissipate it. It's not something that you accumulate, it's not something that you show off. And the contrast between that and the United States is well, it's huge. It's I would say that for all terms and purposes, well, most of Europe is socialist right now. Britain is Labour, which is basically social democrats. So is Germany, which is the biggest industrial force in the whole of Europe. Greens have a lot of influence there. Italy has always been known for its communist party, and still they work with money. It's not the money itself. It's the use of money, and you can get extremely rich in Germany if you want, but just as well if you don't. There is a social system of support to fall back on that will be there for you, and say nobody has to pay for healthcare. I mean, if you get sick, here it's like to live you need money. There is no, it's like you need money over there, but hey, if you really can't do anything to get it, then somebody will help you. And whereas here it's all there is. It seems like people are accumulating money, just accumulating it, just for the sake of having it, and sticking it in their ears and pouncing around. It's like the money stops being energy, but like something that's desirable, like love and respect. It's a different attitude towards money that is present really in the workings of the country as a whole. I'm not talking about the people. The people are the same everywhere, but those who have the power and the way they treat it and the greed is greater in America than over here. It is hard to understand why a country that is the most powerful on the planet spends like two times, twice more energy per capita. Energy in general than the next one in the world, which is Germany. Germany is a very prosperous country, and very prosperous. There's nothing you can't have in Germany. You probably get it easier in Germany than in the United States. But an average American spends twice more energy than the Germans do. You know, electricity and stuff. People leave their lights on, their fans on in a room they're not in. It's like, why do that? Really, why the purpose? The impression that you would get if you grew up in that society and accepted that as normal was that energy was infinite, which it isn't. You know, I'm going to sound like a green fanatic right now, but trees are getting cut down. They do give us oxygen, which we breathe, which is why we live, etc., 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 etc. We're destroying our planet. It's not free. We are paying for it. Sooner or later, we will. And if you don't, your kids will. And if you don't care about your kids, then you should kill yourself. Basically, it's just an attitude. It's like we're the greatest. We have it, and we don't care. Say you're watching the news in Germany. Say you watch the news in UK. They'll have general elections in India. Demonstrations in the Philippines regularly on the news. And here, the local news, the television stations that you get over cable, that, I mean, unless it's CNN or some international channel with BBC America, are very localized, and they're about things that, I mean, I'm shocked. This is America, this is free speech, this is information age, and to really get something, you have to go to the internet. But living off CNN is impossible, whereas CNN International is a completely different thing, because they know, say, Europeans won't buy the same information that Americans will. People are seemingly less concerned with what happens in the rest of the world. Unless it affects them, of course. You know, if Iraq doesn't give oil, then we will go and take the oil. You know, and that kind of stuff. You know, who's the new Prime Minister of Australia is completely irrelevant. The new outbreak of mad cow disease in New Zealand is irrelevant as well. You know, blah, 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 blah. Oh, and a tiger escaped from Nashville Zoo. What? You know, this is something I'll expect to find in a monthly edition of Zoo Fan Club. You know, it escaped. Go catch it. Don't put it on national TV. It's like, it doesn't deserve the time. It's not an important piece of information. It's just a value system. It's almost people are being lulled into a sense of security. Everything else is being screened away from them. I can't imagine, you know, NBC regularly showing documentaries about hunger in Africa. Like, explicitly. You know, I go there and there's Crossfire, and they got some Republican cross-eyed senator talking about whether we should put 10 commandments in the classroom or not. And then a week later, they have the same thing. Yeah. And it's just on and on and on and on. And I guess, you know, but it's a free country, that's what I think. Hey, if you don't like me, go sue me, you know, with the harnesses.
Do people in Bowling Green talk to you a lot about the war in the former Yugoslavia? They try to.
Bowling Green natives?
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't meet any Bowling Green natives. Very rarely I do. That's one thing, okay? A person who doesn't speak English, who spends a year in a town the size of Bowling Green in England, will know English. You cannot avoid communication with locals. People walk on the sidewalks wherever you are, people communicate, people don't patronize, people want to know, people care, and you want to speak to the people because all of a sudden you feel like you're in England. When you're in America, you just feel like, oh, well, okay, I'm in America now, I guess. It's like when you go to Rome, you feel that you're in Rome, you feel the Roman atmosphere. When in London, you feel the London atmosphere. When in Berlin, etc., etc., etc. Here, it is so undefined. Everything is split into little old groups, and everybody's let alone to make a home for themselves. Whatever their vision is, go make it come true. Realize your dream. The sense of society is very abstract, if there is one. And it's based on wonderful things. Tolerance, universal freedom for all. But it's almost like there is a fear towards society and good social standards. It's like, well, if we have that, then we can't have this. But you can. You can be, you know, a German, ethnically proud of it, and you know, you can also have free speech and everything else. In fact, say I was a Satanist. Okay, say I was a Satanist. Well, you're laughing, of course. Say I was a Satanist, and say I was wearing a t-shirt, you know, with a freshly made photo of a cut-off pig's head on it, and a 666 tattooed across my forehead. Okay? I have the perfect right to be a candidate for, I don't know, Germany's parliament. Okay, it's perfectly okay. Whatever I wear, whatever I have in my body, there is no social stigma. You want to do it? Go ahead and do it. It's you, it's your life, fine. Here, it's like, well, it's just a feeling. Well, I better not. Okay, I think that, but I'm not going to let the other people know, because then they might. It's like certain things are unacceptable here. You know, it's almost like I had more freedom for self-expression over there. Nobody had to bring up the statute or the constitution in Europe. It was just taken for granted. Here, amendments are being quoted all the time. It's like, in order to feel free, you have to really convince yourself that this stuff is true, whereas over there, you just draw up to it. And it's a different feeling. It's not a homely feeling. It's a very, America is a very antagonistic environment. That's what I feel. And that's generally the European view. Everything is out to get you. It really is. You can get go in debt very easily. Everybody wants you to go in debt. They send you like 15 credit cards offers in the mail every single day, and it's so hard to get anything done without money, without fighting, and without sucking up. Oh, let's be real. And I don't know. Yeah, I feel like I'm overly criticizing the country that has provided me with something in the end. But as just like everybody else here, I'm an immigrant, and so are you, and I have a right to do it. And if I love this country, I love America, and you know, I really want it to work. I think the foundations of its constitution and the very ideas it's been built on are absolutely excellent. There isn't a single flaw in them. They work well. You know, maybe if you were nitpicky, really, you could, you know, but you can always do that with any idea. That's the human nature. But I really do love it. The Constitution says if you have something against something, then you know, go ahead and say it. But there's, I don't know, I feel like a fear to walk up to anybody just in the street and say it. It's like people keep to themselves very much.
What do you think the impact of having as many people moving to Bowling Green from Europe or in other countries as well, different countries, is going to have on Bowling Green? Have you seen a difference?
There won't be one very clearly visible for a number of years, I think, but wherever people from my country go to, they usually find a way to get a fairly comfortable life. Some of them become very affluent. So maybe in a few years' time, some names will start circulating. Like, Johnny Webb has a ring right now. Who knows? Robert Stupar might have a ring in 4 years, you know. Or Robert. I know Robert. I had a drink of him once. Great, I'll give you a role in my new movie. You know, that kind of stuff. But I think it's natural. On the contrary, the way I'm speaking really does. I would, if I was listening to myself, I would perhaps get the impression that I disagree with everything that's happening with America. But I think that, you know, people should just keep on doing it. America is, once was a nation state when Indians were here. They were natural with it, they respected it, and the white man came and screwed it all up. Pardon my French. The French will probably be insulted by that, but never mind. There is no going back. There is no room for corrections. America is too big to mess with, and I think humans have over the course of history proven their ability to make something come out of nothing, whether they credited it to themselves or to divine intervention. I think it will all turn out okay in the end. It's perfectly natural for immigrants to come to America. Americans are immigrants. Everybody is a mixture of something. And I don't worry about it one little bit.
What would you want people in the future to know about your experience here? The one thing, if you have children and they listen to this tape, or their children, great-grandchildren listen to this tape, what do you want them to know about your life? What would be a message to them?
It's hard to say. Perhaps if you gave me a year to write a novel about it. About my life? Oh, I don't want them to know, to worry about my life. My life is for me to worry about. I want them to worry about their life. If I have kids, I will expect from them to really know what they're saying about before they say it. Really think something through before they come to a conclusion. To be extremely critical and first and foremost to criticize me. Because they are my kids, and therefore they will be my kids. Oh God, I'm talking in present simple here. This is not good. I will want them to be better than I am, and actually they will be better than I am. My set of values is my set of values. Their set of values would be their set of values. I'm quite unlikely to come up to them and seriously say this is not good. I don't know what to tell them about my life. I really don't. I lived and I died. That's about it. You know, you go ahead, you live and you die. And this is certainly there is certainly a higher purpose in life. Whether you choose your own unique, customized version of spirituality and awareness of everything that exists, or whether you take a path that is freely available at every corner in Bowling Green, through the numerous churches, as well as any other religion in the world, you're free to take it. Just go ahead. Feel free to be afraid. Don't be afraid to figure anything out, because you can do it if you persist. And above all, don't take offense. Offense is a very dangerous thing, and people don't offend other people. People get offended themselves. I think negative feelings are by far the greatest obstacle to any success, and positive feelings are by far the greatest distraction if there's too much of too many of them. I would ask them politely and humbly to try to understand harmony and the universe and the time and everything that exists and their part in it. And I hope that the conclusion they come to is that they're a part of it just as important as any other part. And that they try to spread that awareness to others. I don't know how. Kids, if you do know, please tell me. So I don't stutter anymore and feel all this nervousness.
So. You work at the refugee center?
Yeah.
Teaching English. What do you think about... Tell me about the refugee center.
The refugee center?
Yeah. And your experience, or the experience of people as they come into the city, the refugee center.
Okay, should I practice Southern hospitality and be polite about the refugee center here, or should I put forth my version of reality?
If you don't want to talk about it, you don't have to. But you could be candid.
Candid?
Yeah.
I don't appreciate candidness.
Okay.
Really, so unless it's absolutely necessary. But there's no enemies here whom I have to be candid for, no battle to win. So I think that the refugee center is very badly organized and the people who are doing it have no clue about what they're doing. But it's working somehow. The people who are coming in are carrying it through, and pardon the expression, we are kicking their ass. And it's a nasty state of affairs. The office doesn't have enough resources to handle all the people that are coming in. When the people come in, they're not given the adequate support. Not meaning they're not given enough money, but they're not given adequate support. They're not made to feel at home, made to feel like a part of the greatest thing, of Bowling Green, of Kentucky, of the States, of the world, whatever. And they're simply, it's sometimes it's just too much of a business deal, and it shouldn't be. This is new lives that we're creating, and I feel that the attitude is wrong. Now, you know, the employees and the bosses certainly justify it very well, but over the course of history, again, you know, if you work at it, you can pretty much prove anything you want. You know, just choose a stance, and you'll be able to justify it. But I wouldn't call it my home. I do this not because of the refugee office, but because of the people. And really, the only thing I do now is just teach English. I used to be an actual employee. My title was resettlement assistant. Wow, PhD. So I don't do that anymore because there's very little one can do. People don't try where they can, and sometimes they don't smile, and sometimes people are very selfish. And everybody blames it on somebody else, and if that fails, then they just ignore it. I don't know. I wish it the best. I don't want it to stop existing by any means. It's way too early. Even if people stop coming in right now, there's too many who have already come here who do need support and translation services and what have you. But yeah, it could have been done better.
There was a fire, just for the tape even, there was a fire recently in an apartment building. And how many families were living there? They were just resettled here?
I'm not quite sure.
But I think there were about 40 people that were living there, and the apartment building caught fire.
8 apartments in the whole building, I think. I'm pretty sure it's 8.
And they were all from Kosovo. What's the...
Well, some of them were from Bosnia, but let's not be picky.
Were somebody from Bosnia?
Yeah, okay. They were immigrants from, Bosnia and Kosovo.
What do you have to add to that? This is a recent event that is sort of devastating.
I think I should call him Alanis Morissette for that one. Isn't it ironic? Yeah, you get your family out of a war zone. You manage to take some of your belongings with you. You were ecstatic about being alive. You come to America, everything is going well for a few months, and then everything you have is burned down. it's black humor. That's what it is. I don't know what else to say. Shit happens.
Yeah.
That's it.
Have people at the refugee center been doing anything?
Oh yeah, they've spent a considerable amount of money. I don't know how much, but you know, thousands of dollars resettling them, because these people lost everything. Everything that they brought over from their home, it was lost now. Most of everything that could burn was burned. So this is starting anew for them, and they had to be just supplied with, you know, stuff and this and that and everything, and it was stressful for everybody. And actually, there's a family in my class who was, you know, one of the victims of the nasty occurrence, and it was just terrible seeing them there. They had no motivation. They were just like, oh man, you know, I can't believe this. So it's just very, very bad luck, I guess. I do feel anger for the owner of the building, who did not who is probably the first one to be called responsible for, you know, having electrical circuits operating in the building where, you know, sparks fly freely. It's not a good thing. I wouldn't do it, and that person who insures hell is not going to get any respect from me or anybody else. So it's not their fault. It's like something happens to you and you didn't invite it, and it just breaks down your door. It's just bad. Nasty.
Do you have anything else that you'd like to add? We've been talking about different...
Well, how much tape do we have left?
We can always go to more.
Yeah?
I'm tired, yes.
Yeah. I don't know. You know, I'm 22. My composure is not very good yet. People say that humans reach their verbal expression ability peak around the age of 30. So if I'm left alone to talk about anything, you know, any potential listener will not be able to follow me. So unless you don't have any more questions, it's better for all of us involved to stop right now. But it's been a pleasure talking to you.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.